Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Today.
It's 3 minutes after nine, and thank you so much for staying with us. So I think you remember last week we started a series discussing draft treaty on the crimes against humanity. And that's obviously a conversation that we started having with Wendy Isaac. You may remember her, who is from Madre, who took us really through what South Africa was doing in their efforts to make submissions to this draft treaty on crimes against humanity, the struggle for justice and accountability for apartheid. I said we're going to have conversations over the next 4 weeks. This is now our second week in trying to get us to better understand what this means for us, particularly in South Africa, and how we can also inform what goes into our own submissions as the South African government. And more importantly, where you come in, right? So how do we connect all the dots, and where do you come in as a South African citizen? We've invited Executive Director for Foundation of Foundation for Human Rights, Dr. Zaid Kimi, who's in studio with us, who I think are also very, very interested in these draft treaty, in this particular draft treaty, and their take on why our submissions are so important. Dr. Zaid Kimi, thank you so much for making time for us. Thank you for coming through as well on a public holiday.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It may seem like I'm asking you very basic questions, but I think it's important in the context of what it is that we want to outline, just for you to really get us to understand what the Foundation for Human Rights was set up to do.
The Foundation for Human Rights was initially set up in 1995 as an entity, a joint entity between the European Union and the South African government. And its main aim was to undertake work to promote and protect our constitution, mm-hmm. as well as serving as a grant maker for civil society generally. And that's a task that was sort of accomplished. And after about 10 years, the foundation changed. So mm-hmm. it was no longer, it was originally the European Union Foundation for Human Rights. It became the Foundation for Human Rights, and we operated independently of the South African government and the European Union, although we continue to distribute funding on behalf of the European Union.
You've been at the forefront of trying to get justice for many South Africans, and we know of the bigger cases, especially after the TRC. We know of the big landmark cases, some yet, you know, with no justice at all for the families. The Simelane case, we don't have conclusions there. Some wins. You've had some good leaps in some cases. But talk to us about the legal framework with which you've relied on to advance justice, getting justice for these families in South Africa.
Yeah, so of course the core issue was that after the TRC, there was a commitment and an obligation on the South African government to prosecute or investigate and prosecute cases where either amnesty had been denied or no amnesty had been asked for.
Yeah.
You know, we had this historic compromise that said, you tell the truth about what you've done, and in return, you get complete amnesty.
Yeah.
It's worth just reminding everyone that that amnesty was both criminal and civil. So you would be completely off the hook.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, many people came forward and told their story and explained what they'd done and received amnesty for all sorts of crimes, from abduction to murder. But there were these cases where people were denied amnesty because the people in charge of that process, which was a formal legal process, decided that they hadn't told the truth, complete truth, and so the amnesty was denied. And there were about 300 of these cases that were then in about 2002, 2003, handed over to the South African state.
Mm-hmm.
And the South African state then affirmed that they had this obligation to investigate and prosecute. Now, you know, we're not naive. like with many criminal cases, there's no guarantee that there would have been a conviction in any of these cases. That, you know, the police still have to do their work, the prosecutors have to do their work. But that's what I think we expected. I think we expected, and people were obligated to undertake those tasks and to make the effort to prosecute.
Mm.
And what has been clear subsequently is that for a period of about 15 years, absolutely nothing was done. These cases were simply left to wither on the understanding that eventually, I think, everyone who'd die would go away, there'd be no fuss, and that everyone would be able to get on with their lives.
So you obviously, we've watched how you have been at the forefront of pushing for litigation and for some of these cases to finally sit in court and for justice to prevail.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned the Simelane case, and that was really the case where Nokutula, Simelane's sister, Tembi Simelane, approached the foundation and said, my sister disappeared. She was arrested. She was she was tortured. And the people who came forward said, we let her go.
Yeah.
But her body has never been found.
Yeah.
And it's been widely accepted that she was then killed.
Yeah.
And she asked, can we get some progress on this case? And what we had to do eventually was go to court and force the state to say whether they were going to investigate and prosecute that case. And eventually in 2017, indictments were drawn up against four accused. But that, you know, could have been done in 2003. So it took those 14 or 15 years where absolutely nothing was done. And we were able to then move forward with her case as the first instance where there was some change of heart on the part of the NPA and a decision to actually start investigating these cases.
The families of the Craddock Four have had to go all the way to get to this point where we now are in the middle of an inquiry.
Well, what we have at the moment is the third inquest. And although, you know, the state and the NPA like to portray this as some sort of victory that we're having an inquest, what it is this inquest is a result of the failure of the state when it had the opportunity to prosecute those who were directly responsible. And it had that opportunity in 2003, and we in fact had to go to court again to force them to make a decision on whether they prosecute. I believe that was in 2019 or 2020. Mm. And then we've had various promises on the part from the National Director of Public Prosecutions that a decision would be made soon. She said that in front of a portfolio committee. But eventually all of the suspects died.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, now you can have your third inquest. But the inquest is a direct result of the failure of the state to carry out its responsibilities to at least, you know, properly investigate and draw up charges against the perpetrators when there was still an opportunity to have that trial.
So internationally, I think we understand legally, I think the issue has been framed around human rights violation, but this particular treaty, I think, is trying to get us to codify what apartheid crimes are exactly, and to be quite specific in how we term it, so that we can go past the point where we are reliant on an individual state to prosecute those who are responsible, where in a case like we've named just two cases, where many, many families are yet to see justice and have a lot of unanswered questions, they would have been able to access, I suppose, via international law, justice in that way. We would have been able to move faster, perhaps?
Yes. Usually with international treaties, though, you have to have exhausted your domestic remedies.
Yeah.
So what the state has been very reluctant to do is to formally say that they're not going to prosecute any cases. So what they've been very comfortable with is saying, we are investigating this case.
Yeah.
We have not yet made a decision.
You know? We're still seeing if we've got enough to go with.
And, you know, you can think of that as the sort of prosecutorial purgatory. You know, with the Craddock 4 case, when we presented them with dossiers summarizing the evidence, they could say, thank you very much for that information.
We will apply our minds to it. Yeah.
But, my suspicion was that they were never going to make the decision.
Yeah.
They were simply running out the clock. So that's one of the difficulties, is that the state has acted when we forced them to act. But they haven't actually taken any of these cases and said, we are not going to prosecute because we don't believe the evidence meets a particular standard. And that would open the door for either private prosecutions or to take it beyond South African borders and say these have to be prosecuted in some other domain.
One imagines that politically they would never say that. You know, I cannot see them politically saying that. But there would have been an avenue for one to, as you say, either go private prosecution route or clearly state or show by way of evidence that the state has no intention to.
Yes.
And actually, there's enough evidence out there to show that the state had no intention to do that. One would have, I suppose, been able to gather that information if we had a treaty like this. Let's just say we were at the end of this, to then finally get some sort of movement on some of these cases.
Yeah. Although, you know, we did file the constitutional damages case against the state for its failure to investigate and prosecute, and the fact that we believe that failure was systemic.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't merely a case that people were busy or they couldn't collect the evidence or they lost the file, that this was systemic decision not to prosecute. Yeah. It appears from some recent statements from the Minister of Justice that they believe that this was simply just an unfortunate outcome and that it's just too bad, but that there was no ill intent on anybody's part. We will have that commission of inquiry, and I think we will have an opportunity to put the case that this was a deliberate act. And those who feel differently will have to present themselves and argue and present evidence that this was not a deliberate act.
Are you confident in that commission of inquiry?
Well, we do have some concerns about the scope of the commission of inquiry, but we are going to try and deal with that through the courts. So in particular, we don't believe that the Commission of Inquiry should concern itself with the question of constitutional damages.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that issue is ready to be settled by a court, and that's what we're going to ask for.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think the families and ourselves, I think we welcome the fact that the commission will finally happen. Again, it's worth pointing out that we've been asking for that commission for more than 6 years.
Mm.
Numerous letters written to the president. Mm. There have been recommendations from the commission of inquiry held by the NPA, the commission led by Advocate Insebeza, which recommended a commission of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we previously had some commitment from the then Minister of Justice that there would be some form of a commission of inquiry.
Mm.
Ultimately, it took the threat of litigation to force that outcome. And I think the lesson that's there to be learnt is that simply asking for things doesn't bear any fruit. That there has to be some sort of threat, some sort of force involved. Otherwise, you ask nicely and you simply get ignored. That's one of our key problems with asking the Commission of Inquiry to deal with the question of constitutional damages, is that commissions of inquiry make recommendations.
That's it. Yeah. Can't enforce anything.
It's not enforceable.
Yeah.
The president can then take those recommendations, put them in the fridge,
yeah,
lock the fridge, and then wait until no one cares anymore. And you know, and that's simply the way things work. So that's one of the arguments we'll be making, is that this is not a question that can be dealt with by a commission of inquiry. We know that once that commission of inquiry ends its work, and if it does indicate that there were persons who violated the NPA Act by interfering with prosecutions, that will be another fight that we will be faced with, to force the NPA to prosecute if any people are found to have violated the law, to prosecute them. And we don't expect that they'll do that on their own.
Yeah. So what is your formal take on this draft treaty?
I think it's a useful start.
Yeah.
And certainly it's something that South Africa and the South African government should support.
Mm.
I should point out that we've also asked in many of these cases that the crime of apartheid is a crime against humanity,
mm-hmm,
and the crime of murder is a crime against humanity, mm, be included in the charges.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the NPA has been reluctant to take that route, but in the one case, that of the COSAS 4,
mm,
we were able, the NPA decided, the Director of Public Prosecutions in Gauteng, decided to include those charges. And we were very glad that he did, because those charges have held up. They
yeah
were challenged
yeah
by the defendants, and their challenge was rejected. I know that they've appealed.
Mm-hmm.
They were refused mm leave to appeal.
Yeah.
They've appealed directly
yeah
to the Supreme Court.
Good,
so we'll
yeah
have some further dispute around that. But we believe it's an enormous step to
yes
have those charges included in addition to the charges under the normal South African legal system. And we hope that this will open the door to have these charges included in other prosecutions where they're still possible.
That's domestically.
Domestically, yes.
When we look at what we're trying to get passed through this draft treaty and our own submissions, one can always say that internationally we've always been a little, and I'll say 90% clear of where South Africa's position is,
mm-hmm,
on apartheid, against apartheid being a crime.
Yes.
We've been kind of on the same page.
Yeah.
Are you concerned, or should we be concerned, that now that we are in the GNU, we may have a different position on that internationally?
Yeah, I'm not sure how this will play out,
mm,
frankly. I think that there are certainly incidents within this country
mm
where the reaction to clear human rights violations has not been as direct as one would have hoped.
Straightforward, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you had the statement a couple of weeks ago from the Minister of Sport, Art and Culture,
mm,
that foreigners were no longer welcome in entities under his control.
Completely against the Constitution.
Yeah.
Yeah, as we know it.
Yes. And but there doesn't seem to be any pushback
mm-hmm
from the GNU.
Mm-hmm.
Any sort of discipline enforced on mm-hmm ministers to actually...
Or outrage.
Yeah, follow the Constitution.
Yeah.
When we had the incidents on the West Rand with the informal miners,
mm-hmm,
you had statements that essentially amounted to, they broke the law, they deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
What do you expect?
Mm-hmm.
And again, no pushback. No pushback from our Department of Justice, which ought to be in the forefront of ensuring, as their tagline goes, justice for all. Access to justice for all. This assumption that because people have broken the law, that they've given up all the rights. Their right to a fair trial, their right to dignity, their right to life, all of those can go out of the window just because you're suspected of committing a crime. And no pushback on the part of the state to say, no, here's a clear statement of what we believe in.
In that case then, I don't know how much you've engaged government on the submissions, and I know that one of the key issues was to involve civil society in submissions that governments actually present. Has government been, not open, but have you been involved as civil society, not just your organization, but to be part of the submission?
I don't believe that we've been actively involved. I think it's important that civil society organizations like ourselves play an active role in holding our government to account. Again, our government is governed by the Constitution. They can't take positions which are
anti our
Constitution. And sometimes they'll need our support to be able to point out where those contradictions
are. Blind spots or whatever. Yeah.
And to assist them. I don't think we, want to make any claim that there's ill will.
I get it.
On the part of the state.
Yeah.
But we want to be able to make sure that if you take a particular decision or a particular approach, that you know what you're saying. And you know that where you're potentially running foul of our existing constitution.
Because whether we like it or not, the treaty will be signed.
Yes.
And that's the fear for me, and why I think it's so important to have the series. We often are on the back foot, not just our nation, but many nations that are preoccupied by other things. We really do have other problems. And then realize that there are things about us that we would have wanted to be included or omitted in treaties that that would directly affect us that we are unhappy about. And so the call here is for us to be really a part of this process as much as possible and to understand where our position is and what we should be really keen to look at specifically in at least, guiding the process.
Yeah. And I think if we, as civil society, aren't involved in those processes, then coming around 2 or 3 years down the line and then complaining about what the outcome is.
Exactly, what the treaty actually is.
Is less satisfactory.
Yeah.
So I think we have the opportunity to hold both ourselves and the state to account in how they deal with their international obligations and the inputs they make. And this is a perfect opportunity to demonstrate that.
Have you had a look at their draft statement?
I haven't reviewed their draft statement.
Okay. What would be of concern to you in our own submissions? Or rather, let me say, what should we really be hoping to add into this draft treaty?
I think we want to be clear that we want to uphold fundamental human rights for everyone. And I think there are laws and regimes that target particular subpopulations. And we have to make it clear, irrespective of what the terminology is that's used, that those things don't counter to our view of what human rights entails. And I think those statements have to be, clear and unambiguous. And often, people play sort of real politic with these, and you don't want to offend Party A or Party B. But I think on these fundamental issues of human rights, there isn't really room for nuance.
Gotcha.
We have to say clearly what the position is and what our approach would be if those sorts of infractions were happening within our own country. What our response would be.
Can I then try and see if I understand you clearly? If we are guided by the Constitution as it is, what you're saying is that for us in this country, human rights are everyone's rights.
Yeah.
And so we should be careful not to advance one group's human rights over another. or prioritize or exclude any particular group in trying to advance a particular agenda.
Yes, I think it's easy to find subgroups that...
That you think are more vulnerable?
Yeah, or subgroups that you think whose rights can be sacrificed, you know, for the greater good. And it's important to say that that is not acceptable.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not acceptable to trade off...
Got you.
...the rights of subgroup A or subgroup B. And I think we see that with issues like, you know, gender-based violence.
Yeah.
You know, people saying, well, you know, we're worrying about gender-based violence. What about economic inequality? Shouldn't we solve those problems first and then deal with these? But what that means is we'll pay attention to those problems.
And time passes.
And time passes. And we'll never
get to the other.
We'll never get to the others.
Yeah.
Because there'll always be sacrifice to go. There will be some other issue that we need to deal with.
In the global context, it's tricky because nations all have their different priorities and not all the nations have our constitution.
Yeah.
That's a tricky one. And in your view, how would we lobby other nations, particularly the nations in our continent, to really... I don't know, you know, kind of sway them our direction of human rights being human rights for all, not for some.
Yeah, I think that's...
And I know I'm being very, you know, idealistic here, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, that I think is just an extremely difficult issue. You know, there are cultural issues at play. There are issues of, you know, historical ways of doing things. Mm. And frankly, there are also issues of basic prejudice that the political leadership of these countries have, which they probably are not going to be very keen to walk back.
And some have the mandate, unfortunately, to carry out a particular agenda.
Yes.
You know, their own mandate from their countries where this is the position of the country and that's just that.
Yeah. I think we also have to say that there aren't easy or quick solutions to these problems. So it's not as if our view will necessarily carry the day each time.
Yeah.
But I think it's important, given who we are as a country and what we've gone through, that we're at the forefront of stating clearly what that position is. Even if, you know, you're going to have countries, you know, you take an example, you know, sort of Malawi or a country like Uganda or a country like Saudi Arabia. Mm. They're never going to accept gender equality as a fundamental human right, because that's, you know, simply not part of the way they see the world.
Mm.
That doesn't mean we
do not make our own submissions independently.
Yeah, and we clearly say what that position is and why we believe there are rights violations happening.
What we do have going for us, though, is that we really, apartheid is something that South Africa can speak with authority on.
Yeah,
and we cannot sleep on this because I think that the world understands us to be really an authority on the experiences of apartheid, and so admissions do have some and carry some weight.
Yes, and you know, in apartheid, we can say this was the systematic oppression of a large group of people by some other group. The fact that they were a minority is, you know, part of the sort of way it evolved. But where we see similar patterns happening in other instances, where significant proportions of the population are denied basic human rights, then we have to say that is, in some sense, analogous to what we went through here. And it deserves the same sort of attention. You know, if you'd have asked back in, you know, 1948, you know, whether the South African government was doing something wrong when it had these formal practices of racial discrimination, you probably would have got, it's pretty standard. We do the same thing in the United States.
Mm. You know? Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that morally it wasn't wrong to say that this is a crime against humanity then. That may not be the universal view of it, but we've got to believe that eventually the world comes around to what's right and just.
You've been on the ground for a long enough time as the Foundation for Human Rights to know, you know, the weight of what's at stake here. Mm-hmm. How do ordinary citizens and South Africans rally behind civil society, organize civil society, to really make sure that this dialogue happens and that we are involved and that we do make submissions that in a way represent us as a nation?
I think we've got to be able to get the message out about what the what's fundamentally at stake.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's not, you know, to simplify the message that says, you know, as you've put it, we went through, lived through a system of systematic discrimination.
Mm.
And we understand what it means. We understand what it means, not just that you're economically disadvantaged, but also the psychological effect of being considered less than other people. And we've got to then have the message that, you know, do we want to have that happen to other people? Do we want other people to go through what we did? It may not take exactly the same form, but that's what it means. That you grow up, you are born, and you're told from, you know, the moment that you become aware that you are less than other people, and that means that you are going to have less, you're going to have fewer opportunities, you will live a different life.
You know, unfortunately, history unfortunately has a way of repeating itself if you don't have things in check. And this is one of our, it's our responsibility to keep whoever, because we don't know, whoever in check, to make sure that human rights in this nation, in this country, will always be upheld and nobody ever gets to experience what apartheid took from others. And then there is justice in the end.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, as you indicated, it's hard. Countries and have other problems to deal with. And there are political forces that would like to redirect people's dissatisfaction with their economic, personal, or social circumstances and redirect that not as, in our case, a failure of the state to do its job, but to redirect that to say there's that group of people who are responsible.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, as we've gone through apartheid and come through the other end, that doesn't make us immune to that sort of political posture.
That's it.
Yeah. So today we point, you know, the finger at migrants. You know, tomorrow we point the finger at a slightly different group. Yeah. And they're going to be those forces who are out there. And I think both civil society, but also the state, has to do a better job of countering that narrative. But unfortunately, I think people take the politically expedient route of saying, you know, we don't need to confront these. There's a very interesting case happening at the moment. You remember Operation Dudula?
Yes, yes, I saw that case.
So that CACS,
yes,
is...
They've taken them to court.
Taken them to court, yeah. But also calling the South African police...
Yes.
...to account...
And the Justice Department.
Department of Home Affairs,
yeah, yes.
For collaborating with Operation Dudula. And I think that is critically important because, again, these are state institutions. They ought to be held to account. They can't act on the basis of political expediency or, you know, to make good headlines if we arrest illegal immigrants. You know, so I think those are also, you know, loads of things both we, the civil society, But we also can't let the state off the hook. You know, their obligation is also to push back against these, and they're not doing that.
And in fact, I think they're making submissions opposing that.
Yeah. Which well, they're claiming that
they're not collaborating.
They're not collaborating. We just happened to be at the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. It was just, it was just luck. They were just there pointing out which people we should arrest.
It's important because if you leave room for any exceptions, we really could find ourselves in very dangerous territory. We know this country is if you prick harder, we also divide amongst cultural lines. Mm. It has happened before. We've seen. I mean, it's also what apartheid did to this nation. It can easily happen where, you know, black women are targeted because they take all the opportunities. For goodness sake, all the legislation favors them, and we don't have jobs because of them type thing. And you know, you just never know where this could lead if you alienate one group or prioritize another.
It may seem, you know, absurd to imagine it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's completely beyond our imagination to say that, you know, in 10 years you're going to have arguments about, you know, that group of people from the north, are they really as South African as we are? Why are they getting opportunities and jobs? And, you know, isn't there something wrong here? And as you said, we've seen that in other countries where identified subgroups of minorities are attacked because, you know, maybe they're doing better than everyone else. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're just making themselves a likely target.
Mm.
You know, I think we've, you know, in the South African struggle, because it's been so clearly that anti-apartheid struggle, the white oppressor and the black majority. And of course, that's a fundamental part of the way apartheid was constructed. But in some ways, it hides the fact that these are just people doing incredibly horrendous things to other people.
Mm-hmm.
They may have the veneer of being able to identify someone as part of another race and demean them in that way. But I think we've seen in many other instances where there is no racial difference, there is no ethnic difference, but there is still, people are still able to do incredibly horrible things to people exactly like themselves.
In fact, I was just thinking of what happened in Phoenix. You know, I think sometimes some of these things are bubbling under and you don't want to see them, or you just think it's too difficult to deal with them. But what we saw in Phoenix during the July unrest, I think, was quite telling and quite difficult to confront as a nation, that this is what it actually is.
Yeah. So, you know, and again, I think the West Rand mining incident demonstrates that, you know, where you have black people struggling to make a living and terrible circumstances, suddenly being painted as deviants and criminals and, you know, subject to all sorts of human rights violations, and it's absolutely fine because they, in some ways, not like us. And there's a very narrow gap between them not being like us and you not being like us tomorrow. So, yeah, I think we're not in a good place in South Africa. And again, to some extent, the state and civil society, we have to take some responsibility for putting out a different message.
Well, we can't say you haven't done nothing. As a Foundation for Human Rights, we recognize the work that you've been doing. So thank you for joining this conversation and for highlighting why it's so important for us to be involved, you know, not just wait Really, thank you for coming through as well on a public holiday again.
Yes, no problem at all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Okay. Zaid Kimi, who's Executive Director at Foundation for Human Rights. As I said, you know, we're going to be having this conversation over the next couple of weeks as we try and get all of us familiar with our own role, our own duty in being a part of the South African government's draft treaty submissions. And so, you know, bit by bit, we're going to get there where we all understand what it is and how we can be a part of the submissions that the governments are working on. So I'm going to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to talk to you about an initiative called African Women's Movement. That's going to be after this.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.